which is U.S. versus Machino.
May it please the court. My name is J. Clifford Green. I represent the appellant in this matter, Mario Machino. Machino was charged in an indictment wherein he pled guilty to counts 1 and count 3 of that indictment, transporting and shipping child pornography and possession of child pornography. On July 8, 2010, the district court sentenced him to 240 months on count 1 and 120 months on count 3 to run consecutively. So Mr. Machino has a 30-year sentence. At the sentencing hearing, the government called a victim. The victim alleged that and testified that when she was 4 or 5 years old, the appellant had sexual contact with her that lasted up until the time she was 14 or 15 years old. We sought to introduce the testimony of her father, the appellant's brother, who would have testified that, who in fact did testify later when I called him as a witness, that as to that abuse, the victim, my client, my witness's father, had told him that the victim made all that up.
So
it never happened. She made it up for attention.
First of all, this is at the sentencing stage in which the rules of procedure are materially different than they are. All this is after guilty pleas. We don't have to worry about a guilt stage. And you were able to bring to the sentencing judge's attention the information that you wanted to bring to the judge's attention. So I don't see why, given that it's sentencing, given that the Confrontation Clause doesn't operate at sentencing hearings, and we have simply the judge collecting evidence that's reliable, and the judge finds out that she hadn't told the father, and maybe, you know, who knows, if she was fabricating, the judge could figure out that that's what this was. Why is there reversible error in the way the judge handled it?
I'm glad you asked that question, Judge. The reason I think it is because the judge never got to see that witness under my cross-examination answer the questions about what she had told law enforcement 2 weeks prior to sentencing, that she'd been raped by yet another family member. I think that if the judge had seen her under my cross, he may have reached a different conclusion. And I think that by virtue of the fact that here she is when she was a teenager, she told her father the abuse never happened. I made it up to get attention. That combined with the fact that 2 weeks before sentencing, she told law enforcement that yet another family member had raped her. Now, her father, I told the judge, I said, her father is going to testify that the victim told him that, well, I'm not sure whether or not it was a rape or not. It started out as oral and then went to something else.
Sure. No, I understand that. And, of course, there's a lot that victims say and trauma. But on top of all of that, at the sentencing, as I understand it, evidence of the defendant's online chats was introduced, which corroborated the first hypothesis that it was her father she was lying to and that it really was a case of abuse by the defendant. He refers to his niece in these online chats.
If you look at the entire record, Your Honor, you can see that the way the government got this case was they were investigating another individual. And this other individual gave my client up through a series of emails and file sharing. And one of the identities that my client took on was that of a 12-year-old girl. This was virtual reality. This was my client creating an avatar. A totally fictional fantasy world he lived in.
I thought that was the Mark Myers identity.
Beth Master, Judge.
Okay. All right.
And in terms of, if you look at the chats, you can see that it's always the other person that is the aggressor about what that person wants to do and who he's done and this and that. My client simply responds most of the time. And he responds because it's a situation where he wants to keep the conversation going, albeit as nasty as it is. He wants to keep the conversation going. He has no intent on doing any of this. But he's in this room, this chat room. And he wants to engage these people. He's got this weird fantasy about him being a 12-year-old girl. He said at one point that he was a different person. It's all puffery and fantasy. And I think the fact that this victim came in and testified, it's a fairy tale. It didn't happen.
That's a fact question for the judge to decide, wasn't it? I mean,
yes,
it
is.
You argued that.
It is. It is. I think that by virtue of the fact that we didn't get the chance to cross-examine this young woman while she was on the witness stand, especially in view of the totality of the circumstance here, where she made a statement. First off, she never told anybody that the abuse happened. She never got counseling for it. We have her testimony, and I got cut off at the knees because I couldn't inquire. Based on that, we think that one of our other issues is the judge sentenced him to that 120 months on count three based on an incomplete picture of the record, incomplete picture of the defendant. He didn't have all the full nature and circumstances of the offense or the defendant, the characteristics of the defendant. 30 years is a long time. I mean, he may as well have just taken a pistol and shot her in the head. He'd do less time. And that's the problem here. That's the problem with these guidelines. The guidelines, and I'll give it to the government. The government's right. Ms. Trita doesn't take the guidelines. Congress can say what the guidelines are going to be. The Congress sets out in the U.S. Code what a crime is and what a crime isn't. They set out the minimum and maximum. We believe, and we've said in our brief, that Ms. Trita stands for the proposition that the individual increments within a guideline falls within the province of the Sentencing Commission. And there's a document 40 in the record, our sentencing memorandum. We go into some detail about how Jesse Helms goes in the floor of the Congress when they're debating another issue. He gets two letters from some constituents. And he wants to increase the sentencing guidelines based on these two conservative letters that he received. So he goes into the floor of Congress when they're actually debating the Feeney Amendment. He brings that in when there's nobody, there are very few senators on the floor. So the traditional way that the Sentencing Commission comes up with these guidelines did not happen. There was no national debate on them. There was no empirical data or studies done. It just got slipped in based on these letters. Now, it was stacked, so at some point the senators came back in, Congress did come back in and vote on it, but it certainly didn't happen the way things normally run in the Sentencing Commission.
Well, that's not a Mistretta argument. That's an anti-Mistretta argument. I mean, Mistretta said it's okay for Congress to delegate this responsibility to the Sentencing Commission, but in this case, Congress kept the responsibility itself and exercised
it. Judge, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I think Mistretta stands for the proposition that Congress can do
what it did here.
It can do what it did, but in Mistretta, it doesn't talk. It only talks about basically setting out a crime and the minimum and maximums. It doesn't talk about the individual increments, like all the enhancements that my client was faced with. His offense level was 22. By the time you add up all the enhancements, that's an additional 23. It's cockeyed and skewed. And I think that what happens here is you have a situation where, based on what the Congress did, all of the defendants that are charged in crimes such as this fall at the high end of the statutory maximum. And they fall there irrespective of, in some cases, their conduct. For example, my client had no idea what type of child pornography he was going to receive. He didn't know whether there's nothing in the record that indicates he requested sadomasochistic material. Yet because he was trading with unknown persons he didn't even know, he got a floodgate of this type of material. Now he is sentenced as if he'd actually requested that type of material.
He's sentenced as if he possessed it, which he unquestionably did.
He pled guilty to that. He did possess it. Right. He did possess it, but the guidelines doesn't account for somebody that possesses it who actually intends to possess it versus somebody like my client who did not intend to possess that type of material.
Well, he knowingly possessed it. There's no question about that. And whether he asked for it is beside the point. Except as an argument to the court's Booker discretion, which was unsuccessful here.
My only point is that the guidelines will sentence an individual irrespective of what he intends to possess, the type of material he intends to possess. And that's, I think, patently unfair. And the reason it's unfair is because the Sentencing Commission did not go through its empirical data, the traditional studies, the interviews, the way they normally do things. I believe I'm out of time.
All right, time, but I'll give you a minute to have it for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
Ms. Kroll.
May it please the Court. My name is Angel Kroll, and I represent the United States of America. This Court should affirm the defendant's within-guideline sentence. Turning first to the issue about the cross-examination of the victim, what happened here was that the defendant had an opportunity at sidebar to tell the district judge here what the evidence was that he wanted to cross the victim on. The district judge heard the defendant's argument and determined for several reasons that that type of cross-examination on that particular issue was irrelevant and would not help the district court in determining what the appropriate sentence would be for this particular defendant. And the district court said that one of the reasons why it would not help him in making that determination was that the defendant himself was not involved whatsoever in this very recent rape of the victim. There was no allegation that he was involved. And the circumstances of the victim's recent rape, and her molestation as a child were completely different, both substance-wise.
And this was the only line of questioning that was prohibited, the line of questioning about the more recent rape allegations made by this victim against her stepbrother.
Yes.
But otherwise, cross-examination of the victim was fully permitted?
Correct. It was full, it was complete, it was thorough on a number of issues that the defendant was able to then argue to the district court when it came time to argue the 3553A factors, which he then did.
And the same with the father? The father was called as a defense witness, is that right?
He was called as a defense witness. However, the district judge did prevent a line of questioning on the issue of the recent rape.
Same issue,
but allowed a direct examination of the father regarding the child molestation of the victim and whether the father had any information on that issue, but not on the issue of the recent rape. So
the reason, of course, for the interest in it is just to find out whether this victim is the sort of person who goes around fabricating allegations of sexual abuse, in which case, I mean, in other words, it's a credibility issue vis-a-vis the victim. It's not a question about whether the defendant has done something or has not done something.
Correct, and that's how the district judge viewed it, whether or not it was a credibility issue. And on that issue, the district court determined that there really was no evidence that the recent allegation of rape was false, and that there was just some vague statement that the father might testify to about what his daughter told him the day after the recent rape. And I think defense counsel here has gone beyond the record as to what that statement was going to be, because when he proffered the statement to the district judge at the sidebar, all he said at that point was that the victim said something along the lines of she didn't know, she wasn't sure. And that was it. And that's all the district judge had to consider as to whether or not this testimony would have been relevant to her credibility. And based on that, the district judge said, that's not going to help me. There's nothing there. It's not concrete enough. That statement is not concrete enough for me to determine that this recent alleged rape was false.
And so it wasn't a recantation. She didn't say that she made it up.
Not at all. She never did.
She disclaimed accurate memory about it, apparently.
We don't know exactly what the statement would have been. It was vague. But there was no allegation that she recanted. Absolutely not. The judge said that kind of statement...
Tell me again what it was that she wasn't sure, couldn't remember.
She didn't know. She wasn't sure.
About what, though?
Exactly. That's the question. It wasn't proffered.
About the recent rape? So she's asked some question?
About the stepbrother?
Correct. This is a conversation she had with her father the day after the incident with the stepbrother.
Not about the molestation by the uncle,
no.
The defendant here?
No.
Okay.
And so she's not sure what she told her father. Is that what
according to her father, this is a statement that her father, this is at the sidebar, defense is proffering what the father would testify to. And in that context, all that was proffered was that she would say, that she told her father that she didn't know, she wasn't sure. Based on that, the district judge said that kind of statement is not concrete enough, it's not going to help me. It's more relevant to the local authorities who are investigating this recent crime, allegation of a crime, and that's something that the local authorities should talk to her father about. That's not something that I am going to use in my determination as to whether or not she's credible or as to what sentence I should impose.
On that record, that's probably right, but under a lot of rape shield laws, prior false accusations would come in as an exception to a rape shield law.
Correct. And that's when they are false. And there was no evidence here that this was false.
Right. So, I mean, it's not categorically to be excluded. It's just that you didn't have enough here to include it.
Right. Under these facts.
There
correct.
Wasn't any similar equivocation by the victim about the molestation and, I guess, pattern of sexual intercourse, in fact, by this defendant during her childhood. She didn't equivocate on that.
There was one incident when she was in high school, before she had come out, so to speak, about the molestation, she first confided in her sister. And at that time, the victim was no longer living with her family, and she was living elsewhere with her estranged mother. And at that time, her sister, who now knew about the abuse, took it upon herself to tell the rest of the family about this abuse without telling the victim whatsoever. And so the victim was blindsided that all of a sudden all of my family knows about this abuse. She testified about this fact. She testified how she wasn't ready at that point to talk about it to anybody other than the people that she confided in, her sister. She wasn't ready for her family to know. And then when she was confronted at that point by her father, she initially denied it.
But she was fully cross-examined on this?
Absolutely. This was something that the district court heard, was able to assess her credibility on, and then in fact later commented on her credibility on that issue, saying that that is something that's perfectly understandable, and then how it's even more understandable that when the defendant was later charged with child pornography possession and transportation, that at that point the victim would feel more comfortable coming out to her family and go to the authorities because she felt that people would then believe her.
But there were no limitations put on the cross-examination of her on that episode or the direct examination of the father, apparently?
None at all. Okay. That was fully developed, thoroughly explored in both direct and cross-examination. So we don't believe it was an abuse of discretion here for the district judge to determine that that particular issue should not be explored on cross-examination, the issue about the brother, the recent allegation against the brother. That was something within the district court's discretion. Now, turning briefly to the sentence imposed here, it was a guideline sentence, 360-month sentence. A guideline sentence is presumed reasonable on appeal, and it's the government's position that it is, in fact, reasonable here, given all of the aggravating factors that this particular defendant, that applied to this particular defendant. There was a 10-year molestation of his niece, which, Your Honor, was corroborated by the chats. And I wanted to clarify that one issue about the screen names. He had multiple online personas. One of them was indeed Beth Master, which he portrayed himself as a 12-year-old girl. But then there were several other Mark Meyer personas, which he portrayed himself as an adult. And so in the Mark Meyer personas, he did multiple times refer to his niece and sexual acts that he performed with his niece. And the way he described his niece in those chats described the victim in this case to a T, age-wise, action-wise, even sexual preference-wise. Described the niece in such a way that it was very clear that he was talking about her. And when the defendant argued at sentencing that this was some sort of virtual reality, the district judge didn't put much credence in that, said that there was all this other corroborating evidence to support the fact that this abuse occurred, and that the district judge went so far to say that he was convinced she was telling the truth, that there was not a doubt in his mind that this abuse happened based on her testimony and all of the other corroborating facts. As far as the argument, the legal argument relating to Ms. Stretta and whether or not there was a violation of the separation of powers here, I believe that this court has already ruled on that issue. There's precedent there, and we would just ask the court to follow that precedent. Because this was a within-guideline sentence, it's presumed reasonable, and we ask that the court affirm the sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you for the extra minute. The appellee has mentioned that where the victim was living. I need to point out that the victim actually, after the appellant was released on bond, he went to live with his parents. The victim, after the appellant went to live with his parents, he lived with his parents. The victim began living in the same house. And there was some cross-examination about that as well. So when you put all this together, I have to question whether or not the abuse happened at all. If it happened, what is she doing living back in the same house with the appellant? One of the things that I hoped to get from the father was that the victim did tell law enforcement she was raped. But she told the father, I'm not sure whether it was rape or not. I'm not sure. So that amounts to a recantation. Now, I think if the judge had seen her under my cross, he perhaps would have gotten a different view of this victim. He may have not been so draconian in his sentencing. We ask some relief from the 30-year sentence that was imposed. Thank you.
Mr. Green, you took this case by appointment, did you?
I did, Judge.
Thank you very much for your excellent representation. You're fine. Thank you. Appreciate it. Case will be taken under advisement.